It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, art and music education has been part of schools for decades, and there's been new movement toward STEAM education, adding art into science, technology, engineering, and math. It's a good chance you took art classes throughout elementary and middle school, maybe beyond. But our next guest says we can take things further and breathe new life into schools if we use the arts to rethink and ultimately save our education system. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you value having art and music classes in schools? What did it do for you, you think, as a person? And did your non-art classes encourage creativity in some way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Erica Halverson is professor of curriculum and instruction at UW-Madison's School of Education and the mayor of Whoopin'Soccer, a youth arts program based in Madison. Erica is the author of How the Arts Can Save Education, Transforming Teaching, Learning, and Instruction. She recently started a podcast. It's called Arts Educators Save the World. Erica, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with an important distinction here. I think when I think of art classes, I think elementary school, we took a break, walked over to art class, did art. Or high school, I took as many band classes as I could. You're talking about something different, though. Kind of having an artistic mindset, I think, behind education. Can you talk about that?
Sure. First of all, I want to say that I also think about the concept of the arts more inclusively, to consider any kinds of disciplines where people produce things. So the performing arts, the visual arts, the media arts, all are encompassed under this umbrella of arts and arts education and art making. And then also to talk a little to your point about art making, not just as a distinct and separate task from the quote unquote real work of school, but of artistic ways of knowing and doing and being, as central to what it means to teach and to learn and to become human across all the spaces where we think about education and schooling.
Can you paint us a picture of what that might look like in the classroom?
Sure. So one of the core things that we learn when we make art is how to create representations. That is, how to take an idea, a concept, a story, and retranslate it using the medium of a particular art form. So a painting is a representation. A theatrical performance is a representation. A TikTok video is a representation. The same core mechanism that we value in art making is exactly what we hope our learners across all of our disciplines can learn to do in school. So a math equation is also a representation. It uses the tools of mathematics to communicate a complicated idea that is difficult to share using other mechanisms of communication. So my vision for reinvigorating life and creativity into schools is to recognize how the arts give young people access to the kinds of practices that we really care about that they do in all of their schooling lives across the full school day. So it might look like a project that stretches across the visual arts classroom and the mathematics classroom. It might look like using some of the tools of teaching in improvisation and applying those to the science classroom. It might be something as simple as giving kids the opportunity to take risks in their classroom space that they might not otherwise take without working together around an artistic process in order to get free them up to do the disciplinary academic work in the other parts of their school day.
You just mentioned risk-taking, and I wanted to talk about that a little, because, you know, at various points in my schooling and professional life, the main thing I wanted to do was not be wrong.
Yeah.
And that isn't always the most conducive to learning stuff. Can you talk about the value of risk-taking and the opportunity to be wrong?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the biggest challenges we face in the current failure-focused environment of schooling is how do we communicate both to kids, but also to educators, that failure is a part of learning and not a lack of learning? How do we encourage learning environments, that is classrooms, after-school spaces, sports teams, interactions between tutors and students? How do we encourage them to think about trying new things, trying ways of knowing, putting out there ideas that you may or may not believe to be ultimately the best answer as part of what it means to do learning? And learning to take risks is the most effective mechanism for that. And for better or worse, as you probably know, and as all listeners know, you can't simply say to people, okay, now it's time to take risks, and magically people open up toward risk-taking. You have to, what we call in education speak, scaffold their capacity for risk-taking. And I love the scaffolding metaphor because it invokes images of a building held up at first by an external set of tools that then slowly are taken away as the infrastructure for the building is built and can then stand on its own. And so in my book, and in my work with arts educators, I talk a lot about what are the kinds of scaffolds that arts practices allow us to build so that we can eventually take them away and embed risk-taking into the everyday practices of teaching and learning.
Talking to Erica Halverson from the UW-Madison School of Education. New podcast called Arts Educators Save the World. You could join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about arts and creativity, how to get them into the classroom, not just the art classroom or music classroom, but all day long. If you're a teacher, what do you think of the ideas you're hearing? Are you able to do this? Have you found ways to do this in your own classes? As a student, past or present, were there teachers, were there classes that really stimulated your creativity? And did it help you learn more? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Erica, this new podcast, Art Educators Save the World, just out last week. Want to listen to a bit of it? Lin-Manuel Miranda on here and Robert Lopez and their teacher, Barbara Ames, in a conversation. Here's Lin-Manuel Miranda talking about a life-changing teacher.
It was life-changing for me. I think the direct education we got from Barbara wanting us to like go headlong into running our own show and the empowerment that comes with student-run theater, because I saw from seventh grade onward what could be done. And then I directed West Side Story my senior year for musical rep. And I grabbed the stuff from the movie I wanted to. I did the Boy Girl America. I swapped Krupke and Cool. I went to the Barbara Ames School of Make the Best Show Possible for Your Students.
Also, I believe your teacher, Barbara Ames, was the let's put on a show model of teaching. Could you talk a little bit about what you got out of that conversation?
Oh, so many things. I mean, not to sell my own radio, but I would encourage everyone to subscribe and listen to these amazing conversations. The idea behind the podcast in general is successful artists talking with their mentors about the impact that arts education has had on their lives. And we started with Lin-Manuel Miranda and Bobby Lopez because they had the same transformational elementary school music teacher as did I. And we, all of us, attribute the kinds of experiences that Barbara Ames gave us directly to the kinds of human beings we became. And part of that was Barbara's commitment to engaging all of us in the process of making theater and making music. Part of it was the ways in which she encouraged us to take risks in our own artistic lives as pretty young children. You know, she was our teacher when we were in kindergarten through sixth grade. And you heard a little bit from Lynn, and the same is true for myself. And, you know, if listeners don't know Robert Lopez's name just from hearing it, he is the co-writer of Frozen, the movie soundtrack and musical, along with several other Broadway musicals. So these are incredibly accomplished composers, songwriters, some of the greatest of the 21st century. And Barbara is the one who gave us access to our creative selves as young children and encouraged us to carry that forward through creative projects in our schooling lives beyond our time with her, as Lynn said, into high school, both of them obviously into college. And for myself, as an artist turned academic, thinking about the relationship between the stories that she helped me figure out how to tell and improving other people's lives through education, it is an unmatched set of experiences that we got through our education with Barbara.
We're talking to Erica Halverson, professor at UW-Madison School of Education, author of the book, How the Arts Can Save Education. Her new podcast, we were just talking about it, is called Arts Educators Save the World. She joined us to talk about her research on the value of art in schools and not just in separate art classes. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you find in your schooling, say, a teacher, a class, a style of teaching that helped boost your creativity? And did that help you grasp difficult topics along the way? If you're a teacher yourself, do you find ways to encourage creativity in your students? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Erica Halverson, UW-Madison education professor, author of the book, How the Arts Could Save Education, with us today to talk about research on the importance of using art in the classroom, not just in the art classroom. You could join in at 800-642-1234 to share your experience, maybe your questions for our guest about how to put some of these ideas into practice. Again, 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Michael is with us in Spring Green. Michael, hi.
Hi. I was just mentioning the fact that I'm a professor emeritus, taught at the University of Wisconsin-Madison for many decades in the art department. And I had students, young adults from all kinds of different fields that were in my classes, different majors, everything from computer science to medicine. And I always expected that out of the group, maybe one would become an artist. But what I think the arts really contributes to a bigger picture is the idea that the critique and criticism is a very valuable skill. And it encourages critical thinking, which can apply to just about any profession. And I think art people that have art backgrounds see things differently than just any other person does. And it's because of that ability to see things in different ways that they can apply those skills to just about any profession.
Michael, thanks for the call. Erica, what do you think?
Yeah, that Michael was not a plant, although I think very well could have been. Critique practice is a great technique for engaging teachers who maybe aren't arts teachers in some of the ways of knowing and doing that we really value in the arts. In my own classes at the university, I teach folks who are planning to become teachers, and I also teach folks who are artists who want to become teaching artists, that is, teach in their lives but maybe not become certified classroom teachers. And one of my favorite days is a day I call Getting Beyond Good Job, which is where we learn how to talk to one another about the work that we make to develop some of those critique skills that Michael was talking about. So learning to notice, that is engaging with a piece of artwork, whether that's a piece of visual art or performance art, and learning to notice things in the work is an excellent mechanism for developing a teaching and learning technique that can be utilized across different disciplines, because it allows us to engage with one another's work without evaluation, first of all, and by giving the kind of productive feedback that allows people to improve on their representations, on the ways in which they're communicating ideas to each other.
Michael, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Erica, for somebody wanting to put that idea into practice, I think we hear words like critique and criticism and think, here's how the thing you did was bad. And that's clearly not what you're talking about. For somebody, maybe a teacher out there listening who wants to do this in the classroom tomorrow, what could that look like?
Yes. So there, I mentioned learning to notice. I have a very simple set of questions that I use to teach about critique that I've adapted from Harvard Project Zero, which is a very well-known kind of arts education research house around the country. And they have a lot of free resources on their website. But my kind of simplified version of critique is having people present work to one another and asking everyone to respond to the questions, what do you notice? What does this remind you of? And what do you still want to know? And the reason I like those questions is that they surface the parts of someone's work that stand out to others without any evaluative language associated with it, right? So for example, someone might notice the vibrant colors in a painting. That doesn't mean you like the vibrant colors, you don't like the vibrant colors, but you notice those colors. And that is an opportunity for feedback and conversation where the artist can say, yeah, I was really thinking the vibrant colors could do A, B, or C. Or, you know, I hadn't really intended for vibrant colors. I see that everyone is noticing that. Here are the kinds of changes I'm going to make to this work in order to make the colors less vibrant so that that is not the first thing that people notice when they examine my work.
Talking to Erica Halverson, professor at UW-Madison School of Education. Erica has a new podcast called Arts Educators Save the World, talking about creativity in our schools. Erica, something that always strikes me, you know, when I think back to my math education, a lot of it was a chore, drudgery in a lot of ways. And then when I interview mathematicians, they're talking about how much creativity goes into problem solving and how much they play with numbers. I mean, they're doing hard stuff too. How do we get that spirit from the pros and bring it into the stuff that K through 12 kids are getting?
Oh, that is such a great question. You know, I have also heard that from mathematicians. And you hear all the time about the connections between making math and making music, making math and making art. There's some really exciting research around how very old arts practices like weaving are highly mathematized. And there's incredible research going on that starts with the mathematized arts practices and uses those practices as a mechanism to move toward some of the more standard representational tools that we use in math classes. So I would say step one begins with identifying the arts practices that are themselves mathematical. And rather than requiring we start with the standardized math practices and require students pass through those before, quote unquote, getting to the good stuff, what if we started with the good stuff and used those opportunities as a way in to the standardized mathematics practices?
We just have a couple minutes left, and I don't want to get out of this without talking about whooping soccer. Sure. I was going to try to describe it to people, and I don't think I have the right words. What is whooping soccer? What do you do?
Yep. So whooping soccer is a community arts outreach program that's based here in Madison, Wisconsin. We are an artist in residence program. So we bring professional teaching artists into third and fourth grade classrooms, and we work with an entire grade of students on creative expression through writing and improvisation and performance. We each week brings a different theme for creative expression, from writing and telling stories from pictures to telling true stories to learning a little about playwriting and the tools of playwriting as a form of expression to writing arguments that allow young people to make change in their world. We give them opportunities to write together, to write alone, to dictate, to perform each other's stories. And then at the conclusion of the residency, our group of teaching artists, many of whom are also professional performers in the Madison community, create an entirely original vaudeville-style sketch comedy show of the kids' work, and we bring the kids to the Madison Youth Arts Center, and they all have an opportunity to see their work performed on a professional stage by professional artists as a mechanism of validating their ideas as not only creative, but valuable for the community at large.
And in just our last few moments, Erica, it's a new school year. Leave us with a bit of encouragement.
Oh, it's a new school year. I think all of us are entering it with a bit of trepidation. I like to lead with joy. I like to lead with the idea that coming together in community to make new ideas is an act of joy. And arts practices are the best way I know to infuse joy into our learning systems. So I would say, let's start the year with joy by valuing the artistic ways of knowing and doing that kids naturally bring to learning. And let's lift those mechanisms of expression up as valid, as valued, and as a way to bring all kids productively into our learning environments.
Erica, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Erica Halverson, professor at the UW-Madison School of Education and mayor of Whoopin' Soccer, a youth arts program we were just talking about based in Madison. Erica is the author of the book, How the Arts Can Save Education, Transforming Teaching, Learning, and Instruction. She just launched a podcast. It's called Arts Educators Save the World. And you could still share your stories of creativity in teaching and learning, maybe an art class or a creative teacher who inspired you at some point along the way. You can let us know about it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, dictionaries change from year to year. They're living documents. Merriam-Webster recently released their new batch of 370 words and definitions that it says have cemented themselves in popular usage to the point that they're worthy of being added to their dictionary. How does that process actually work? Who makes the call? For some words, does getting printed in the dictionary make them less cool somehow? We're going to get some answers and talk about some of these quote-unquote new words, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you look forward to when these new words come out? An interesting point of curiosity for you. Have you seen some of the latest on the list? Is there a word that's new to you, dictionary or not, that you've come across in slang or technology or food? Hot or not? Do you like the word or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And is there a word that you use maybe in your family or your workplace that's maybe unique to you and your local circle, but it serves a purpose? Tell us about it. 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett are co-hosts and co-producers of the radio show A Way with Words. You can hear them every Sunday morning at 9 here on the Ideas Network. Martha's written books on word origins and has a background in ancient Greek and Latin. Martha, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here, Rob.
And Grant is a lexicographer and linguist specializing in slang and new words. Grant, good to talk to you again.
Hello.
Martha, okay, the dictionaries, they do this every year, sometimes more often, these new words. I grew up, I think I thought the dictionary was the rule book, right? These are the words we have in the English language. These are the ones you can use. That's not really how it works. It's kind of a reflection of a changing language, right?
Exactly. That's a great word, reflection, because the dictionary just reports what's out there. It's more like, we used to have phone books. I guess we don't really have them anymore, but it's more like the phone book than the social register, you know, telling you what you should and shouldn't use. It's a record of how we speak.
And Grant, you've done some work actually producing dictionaries. What can you tell us about the process of determining whether a word makes the cut?
Oh, I could talk for hours about it, but in brief,
he has.
Yeah, I have.
He does.
The brief version of it is it's a very thoughtful process. It's a lot of very bright people spending a huge amount of time, like more time than you can possibly imagine, reading and discussing and gathering data and really thinking about what the public would want to look up. And so they read a wide variety of subject matter. They record all the new uses and all the new words that they find. They put them in databases. Sometimes they record them in physical files. For example, Merriam-Webster has a physical file card catalog of more than 15 million cards that you can see if you visit their campus. And then when it comes time to update the dictionary, they go through and say, well, where are we? What's happening in the world right now? Or where in the alphabet are we? And they go through and they say, well, this is happening and this is happening. And in that way, these incredibly bright and thoughtful people, I mean, this is not something that they take lightly, put these words on the table and argue with a passion that you cannot imagine. I mean, and humor and grace and goodwill about what should be included. And so every word that is included in these new words list is the product of this a spirited process, a generous process. And trust me when I say that these people who put this together, it's a battle. It's a win and a loss every time a word does and doesn't make it.
We'll talk more about the process, but I want to get a taste of some of these new words in the dictionary. And Martha, yeah, let's get a taste of some of the food-related words they've added. Now, here's one. It's two words that were already there, pumpkin and spice, but they're now defining pumpkin spice as a definable phrase. Could you talk about that a little?
Well, yeah, they are indeed, right? For better or for worse. It seems like that just came out of nowhere a few years ago. And now, you know, it's something that you expect, especially in October. Another food word that caught my eye, that or a food term that's recently been added to the dictionary is oat milk, because that is what we call in language a retronym. It's a new term for an existing object or idea to distinguish it from a later development or invention. Like, for example, you know, we used to just talk about guitars, and now we talk about electric guitars and acoustic guitars. Or we talk about, you know, we used to talk just about radio, but now you have clock radios and car radios. So now also you have soy milk, almond milk, oat milk. And another retronym that was recently added that's not exactly food related, but it's meat space. You know this one, right?
Meat space is as opposed to like being on a virtual meeting, right? We're in a place particular, right? Do I have that roughly right?
Yeah, meat space is the real physical world.
Okay.
It's the world of flesh and blood as opposed to cyberspace. And meat space has been around since the early 1990s or so. So yeah,
Rob,
we might say, you know, let's get together with Grant in meat space. So we're not online. We're actually in a coffee shop.
I feel like that was in
Rocky Balboa in a butcher's.
Right. Well, that could be a meat space in a meat space. Definitely.
Yeah, it could be.
Now that's, I feel like that was around an early cyberpunk writing. Right. And so Grant, what's with the time lag there? A phrase that's been around for a long time could take a long time to end up rising to a dictionary's attention.
Yeah, that's what I was saying about dictionary editors and lexicographers being very careful. They don't really jump the gun. Sometimes they're accused of putting these fly-by-night words in there, but the best lexicographers don't do that. They wait. A word has to prove itself. It has to show up for a long period of time across a wide variety of media used across a large spectrum of society, and it really needs to... It really has to have legs, as they say. That's one of my favorite expressions. It has to really show itself. I look at something, speaking of retronyms, something like dumbphone. How long have we been saying smartphone? Well, dumbphone is a retronym of smartphone. It's a phone that is modern but doesn't have any of the smartphone features, and that has been around forever. Even a term like shrinkflation has been around for a while, but it had to prove itself. And you know, it wasn't included just because it's become more commonly known in recent years, because it's not new. Even janky, which is on this year's Merriam-Webster list, dates to the 1960s. janky meaning trashy or broken or badly made. So it really has got to show endurance, longevity.
We're talking to Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett from A Way with Words, looking at a batch of new words that entered, in this case, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, but also how words start and enter a language. And you could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Clem is with us in Portage. Clem, hi.
Well, good afternoon. How you doing?
Good. What do you got for us, Clem?
Well, I got an e-nuke word for you. It's a very especially e-nuke word, which means unique. But since everybody's modifying the word unique, I figured I would make up a new word to mean absolutely, solitarily unique, which is, of course, the meaning of the word.
Clem, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Unique, I think people talk about it being watered down, like it could be, you know, comparatively unique. It's not one of a kind, but close. Now, Clem's trying to coin something. Martha, can we make Inuk a thing? Like
boy.
Fetch. It worked for Fetch, right?
Can we make Inuk? That's a cozy place to read your ebook, isn't it? An Inuk?
That's you know, Clem makes a good point that a lot of people use the term unique and add the very to it, which sort of changes the meaning a little bit. But that's pretty much entrenched in the language now. You know, I mean, sticklers will say if something's unique, it's the only thing like it in the universe. Or the metaverse, or the multiverse. I think maybe you would need one of those compound German words with lots of syllables. I think he was starting down that path. Solitary, absolutely unique.
Definitely. Clem, thanks for that call. Now, he's trying to coin, I think, a slang term, Grant. And I understand you are you're a big fan of slang terms entering the language. You mentioned janky as one of those. Anything else on the new list hitting you from the world of slang?
Well, you know, I'm going to call her out, but your producer, Sarah, said that she uses yeet, even though she's 29, and I hardly endorse
She's not
yeet.
Lying.
And yeet's another one of those. It's older than you think. It's from at least as early as 2007 as an interjection expressing surprise or approval or enthusiasm. And then it was turned into a verb because you would shout it as a interjection when you would throw something. So now it means to throw. And it's kind of the opposite of yoink, which means to take something suddenly. And it's weird because we all thought, I say we, meaning people who studied the changing lexicon, we all thought it was just going to burn out as fast as something like bling bling did. But it really looks like it might stick around for a while because it's still lurking. Martha and I just did a school visit in Huntsville, Alabama, and it turned up on a bunch of the cards of slang submitted by the high school kids there. So they're not done with it yet.
We're talking to Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett, co-hosts and co-producers of the radio show A Way with Words. Check it out on the Ideas Network Sunday mornings at 9. And we're talking about new words being added to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary and other dictionaries. We're also talking about how words make it into language in the first place, too. They get yeeted into the language. Is that Sarah? Thumbs up? No. Yeah, okay, great. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered a word that was new to you recently? Friend or foe, did you like it or not? Do you have questions for a guest about words and how they come to be in general? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret, here now with co-hosts of A Way with Words, Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett, talking about word origins and new dictionary words after Merriam-Webster announced the latest edition, 370 new words and definitions. Let's go back to your many calls at 800-642-1234. Valerie is with us now in Eau Claire. Valerie, hi.
Hello. The word I'm looking at is scrum. So my daughters both played rugby, and the scrum is when the group works together to move the ball. Well, one of the daughters is now working for a company, and she is a scrum manager for her group of coworkers.
And I'm guessing, Valerie, that doesn't mean that her business has a rugby team. It means something completely different, right?
it means completely different that she is, I mean, it's still a group working towards a common goal. But that's the first time I had ever heard anything in business as being a scrum manager.
Interesting. Valerie, thanks a lot for that call. Martha, as I think about it, I guess this probably happens. You know, we might huddle up at a team meeting at a workplace. Sometimes phrases go from the sports world to business and elsewhere.
Yeah, how interesting. I mean, how interesting. Think about baseball, for example. There's so many terms that have been adopted into the business world and elsewhere from baseball. You know, hitting a home run, for example, or touching all the bases. Scrum manager is a new one on me. Have you heard it, Grant?
Yeah, it's part of a project management methodology that it really started to take hold in Silicon Valley and then those sorts of businesses. And it involves certain kinds of principles that I won't get into here about how to manage a process of developing a project so that all parts of the project are respected and all people in the process get their due. So that it's not a top-down process, it's a through-and-through process. I mean, I know that I've shorted it and scrum managers are now shouting at the radio, but it's an established project management philosophy, which you can buy books on and get training in.
As Valerie was talking, I was looking up Scrum Master, and I got to say the descriptions I'm seeing are using a language that I identify as English, but very much corporate
if
speak.
You know, Six Sigma and all that stuff from back in the day, it's reminiscent of that. It's you sometimes wonder if it isn't selling shovels to the gold miners. It's more about getting paid to teach the training than it is about actually getting the training that go well, if that makes sense.
Excellent. All right. Thanks for that call, Valerie, at 800-642-1234. Kevin joins us next in Viroqua. Kevin, hi.
Hi.
What words do you have for us today, Kevin?
Well, one from each side of the family. My mother's side used a term, and it was slaunch-wise. I don't know how she spelled it. But it referred to slaunch-wise was anything that's kind of cockeyed, especially if Dad was lying diagonally on the bed. He was sleeping slaunch-wise. And the other is febble, F-E-B-B-L-E, referring to small fluttering white moths that annoy people inside the house. That's from my wife's side of the family, the febble.
Unique to your family, Kevin. Martha, I dimly remember, did we talk one time about sort of those unique words that we have in our own little communities, whether it's a family or group of friends or something like that? Is that something that a lot of people do?
Oh, of course. Yes, I think every family has its own language and own code and words that are invented by children, for example, and you just keep saying them because they're just so cute and they're little souvenirs of their childhood once they get older. Febbles is the word?
Febble was the little fluttering insect that we don't know the name of for real, I guess. Yeah.
Boy, I don't know that. It reminds me of greebles, which are those little things, those little balls of lint in your pockets.
Wait, there's actually a word for the little balls of lint in my pocket?
I believe there is.
Greebles? Oh, that's also the name of what the cats seem to be chasing when they go crazy in the house and you can't see what the invisible spirits are that they're looking at and nobody else can see. Greebles.
Wait, oh, those are greebles, not febbles. And then the other word, slaunch-wise, has been around for a while. That's
a
dialectal term that has to do with something being slanted or off. A lot of people use the word catawampus or antigoglin or psigoglin, but they're all words for something that's kind of askew, you know, like a picture frame that's not quite hung correctly.
Yeah, it's got about 200 years history in the United States, slaunch-wise.
So, Kevin, that one, I think it was your mother-in-law, isn't making it up. She's actually got a way with words. We're talking to Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett from A Way with Words. Check them out on the Ideas Network Sunday mornings at 9. We're talking about new words entering the language, entering the dictionaries, and you are sharing yours at 800-642-1234. Steve joins us next in Hayward. Hi, Steve. Are you there, Steve?
Hello.
Yeah, go for it, Steve. Yes. What's your word for us today?
My word is E-E-W-E-E. It's spelled I-I-W-I-I, and it stands for it is what it is.
Oh, okay. And is this is something that you say to other people?
Yeah, as far as I know, I made it up and,
okay.
Because we were in a circumstance where we needed to Someone said this so often that we shortened it to E-E-Wee-E. And so it was a little snarky, but I was just curious. I listened to your program on Sundays and love it. And just curious if you've heard of this before or if, in fact, I did make it up.
Okay, so first of all, that particular word acronym, I guess, Martha and Grant, and also, is this a pretty common way that words happen, that they're, in the case of E-E-Wee-E, abbreviations like that?
Sure, yeah. I mean, the one that comes to mind for me is WYSIWYG, you know, what you see is what you get, or WOMBAT, which is a waste of money, brains, and time. I mean, I think some of those, it's just easier to say the abbreviated version, and I'm certainly going to adopt E-E-Wee-E. It makes perfect sense to me.
A quick Google turns up a few places where people have used it, and it actually looks like somebody has trademarked it, but I don't let that stop you.
Yeah, just keep it on the down low, Steve. Don't call into public radio shows and admit that you're using that trademark phrase, whatever you do. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. How about Laura next in Madison? Laura, hi.
Hi. I was calling about the word bi-weekly or bi-monthly, and it always bothered me. What gives? I mean, it's so confusing. And the same thing with winterize. Sometimes it means close down for the winter. Other times it means adapt for the winter. So why is that?
Well, I'm guessing Laura is the only person who's ever had a problem with bi-monthly and bi-weekly, right?
Our advice is usually, Laura, just give it up. Don't bother. Don't
twice
use the
a
word.
Week.
Just put it in a frame and put it on the wall and admire it and just say every other week or every 2 weeks and move on, or twice a week. Just avoid all confusion that way.
All right. Okay. If she really wants to. Martha, do you have a rule or no?
No, there's no rule. Except you're just going to have to explain it every time. That's the problem with it. You're going to have to say bi-weekly. And by that, I mean.
Right. Yeah. There's really no way around it except a word around it.
All right.
You're always going to have somebody show up at the wrong time.
Excellent. Thanks for that call, Laura. Peter joins us now in Milwaukee. Peter, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Hey, I have a couple of comments and then a quick question. So I think I actually have a couple of new words for you to consider, but I'll give you those at the end to keep you.
We just got a little bit of time. Hit us with your main thing, Peter.
The main thing I wanted to talk about is the diminution of the language related to what people think are new words but are really incorrect usages, and also adding words that don't make any sense at all. So your guest mentioned the concept of oat milk. Well, I'm from Wisconsin. I come from a dairy family. And I know for a fact that milk is the food product created by the mammalian class of animals and not some juice of a fruit or vegetable, okay?
Peter, so, I got you. We're just about out of time. Language is, you mentioned oat milk was added to the dictionary here. Language can be contentious. Who wants to bring us out with that?
Yeah, more than one thing. Just for example, that meat, the word M-E-A-T, those same cows give us meat. Meat used to mean all food, not just their muscle matter. So, and what about when you read the Bible, milk is used to mean more than milk of the cow. Huh. So there's lots of things that milk can mean.
All right. And Martha, 30 seconds, a trend you're watching for in new word creation.
Oh, boy, a trend I'm watching for. It's not exactly new word creation, but somebody told me the other day that they liked my drip. And I said, what?
Oh, yeah, that was a high compliment, Martha. You must have been really styling.
Well, I figured out eventually that it was a compliment because it's a word, of course, that we've known historically to mean, you know, drops falling. But if you like somebody's drip, you like how they're styling. Yeah, how they're dressing. It's like they're dripping with diamonds. But that's something I heard from a 20-something, and I was very happy once I actually learned the meaning of that word.
No one has ever said that to me. Thanks to our guests today, Martha Barnett and Grant Barrett, co-hosts of Away With Words. Check them out Sunday mornings at 9 here on the Ideas Network. Keep sharing your favorite words. Email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.